Okay, Bill, are we ready?
Sure, Paul. Oh, wait. Be right back. I need my Avengers Omnibus. Where did I put that thing?
While Bill looks for that, let me tell you about our new endeavor. Two True Freaks has grown, and Back to the Bins is growing with it. I, Paul Spataro, along with Bill Robinson and Scott Gardner.
Just say his name three times in an email and he'll appear in your show.
Hey, how's it going?
Sorry. I forgot I had a Scott Gardner life model decoy in here. Be right there. Ow! Ow, who put Cap Shield there?
Anyway, we're looking to showcase various characters, storylines, issues, or whatever strikes our fancy from the world of the Avengers.
Hey, Ben, move that funny-looking hammer, would you? It's on that book, and I can't move it.
Sure thing, Dad. Where do you want it?
Over there somewhere. No! Watch out for the repulsor! Ow! Oh! Don't tell your mother.
We like to call it Avengers Spotlight.
I thought it was going to be called Old Avengers Never Die, They Just Get Reassembled and Sent to Another Earth. What? Too wordy?
Who knows what we'll cover, and who might stop by?
So join us for the Avengers Spotlight, where we'll look at Earth's greatest heroes and some of comics' greatest stories, such as the Korvac Saga, Acts of Vengeance, the Kree-Skrull War, and, oh, for the love of Christ, who the hell put the Celestial Madonna Saga on this list?
Huh. I found a use for that life model decoy after all. Okay, found it. We ready? Hey, wait a minute. This is the Book of the Vishanti.
Forget it. See you soon, everybody.
My favorite Avengers are D-Man and Green Lantern.
Say goodnight, Scott.
Goodnight, Scott.
And now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
The Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror!
Hello, horror fiends. I am Schultz. I am the Chris Keeper. And I've been bad, and I'm in a well. Got a microphone, and this month's movie is Suspiria by Dario Argento, not by Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Schultzy. Good, Schultzy. I have your elbow and a chewy toy, Schultzy.
No.
Oh, Schultzy! Bad, Schultzy! Put down the microphone! Schultzy, bad! Put it in the basket, Schultzy! Schultzy, it puts the microphone in the basket or it gets the hose again!
No!
Ciao, amici, and welcome back to the Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror. I am one of your co-hosts, Mr. Luke Giaconetti. We're going to be continuing our series of Dario Argento tonight, taking a look at the seminal nightmare on celluloid known as Suspiria. And I'm not stupid. I'm not covering this alone. I'd like to welcome my fellow co-hosts. First off, Mr. Chris Honeywell.
Mamma mia!
Also joining us tonight, Mr. Hair Metal Hero.
Chef Boyardee.
And, of course, last but never least, Mr. Sean Engel.
Rigatoni, everyone.
Yeah.
To see, we're back on food after last time.
Yeah, where is Tony, anyway?
That would be if he was dead, right? Rigger, Tony?
Oh,
Tony's the son of Mamma Mia and Chef Boyardee.
Ooh.
Rick. Tony as like a zombie gangster sounds like a Full Moon Entertainment type of movie.
Cut that out. We're gonna write that movie.
All right. So as I said, tonight we're taking a look at 1977's Suspiria. Generally, in mainstream press, considered to be Argento's most successful and popular film. Definitely a departure from Profondo Rosso that we took a look at last time. This film is, you know, Profondo Rosso is very much set in a sort of realistic, modern setting. This film is anything but that. This is kind of, like I said, like a nightmare captured on film.
I don't think realistic ever came up in my mind for one second in this movie.
I'll tell you what came up in my mind. It was like, you know, when you're a kid and you're in art class and they give you the little tiny rectangular tray of the 8 colors to paint with. Mm-hmm. It's like Dario Argento had one of those and he said, fuck it, I'm throwing every single one of these paints at the lens.
Yep, one at a time. Yep.
Yeah,
starting
surreal.
With pink.
Yeah.
Mm. Pink.
Nothing says scary like pink.
Surreal is definitely a descriptor for this film because nothing in this feels real. Really, it's just out there. Very, very, like I said, very surreal, very not mainstream horror movie.
Yeah.
No, right at the very beginning with the weird, like, tacked on voiceover.
Yeah.
Over the credits that never comes back and never really has anything to do with anything, that doesn't even give you any useful information.
No. And then, right as after Susie, who is played, of course, by Jessica Harper, who will forever hold a place in my heart because she is Phoenix from Phantom of the Paradise. So I'll always love her just for playing Phoenix.
That's why she looks so familiar. Oh my God, I was watching the whole movie wondering why. I was thinking that she looked like somebody I knew, but that's exactly what it is.
The other thing folks either know for either is from Phantom of the Paradise or from Shock Therapy.
Oh, sweet Jesus.
But as soon as this movie starts, and she's walking through the airport, then she gets in the cab, we're already getting those harsh primary colors, like Hiro said, splashed all over her face and what we're looking out the window. And the first clue to this, I think, that this is going to be visually a lot different than what we had seen from Argento was that these harsh colors, they're non-diegetic. They're something that exists only as a visual element in the film. The characters don't even seem to notice it.
Mm-hmm.
Don't notice that suddenly everything is bright yellow for no, you know, no character-driven reason.
Well, the lights are on and everything's pink. Then they turn the lights off and everything's bathed in blue or green light or something, you know.
Yeah, it almost looks like something out of the theater. Mm-hmm. You know, when you turn the lights off on a set on the theater, they've got a backlight, everything, so you can still see it. That's what that really strikes me as, is this is trying to emulate the look of a stage. Which is so appropriate considering that it's set at a ballet school, you know?
Again, nothing more horrific than that.
The ballet school?
Oh, yeah.
But here, you don't it's want a to, satanic you don't want to... ballet What's school.
That? Yeah, it's a satanic ballet school, yeah.
Aren't they all?
You know what ballet school means, though? Ballerinas. Stretching.
Yeah, they're kind of wavy.
Well, what's interesting is that the girls in here are kind of waify, and originally Suspiria was written by Argento and Dario Nicolodi, and it was written originally with the characters all being about 12, and Argento's brother, Claudio, who's the producer, he told him, you can't make the movie this violent with kids in it, because you'll never get it released, even in Europe. So he recast the film, putting everybody, teens and young 20s, but he didn't change any of the dialogue. So that's why some of these people sound like naive girls, is because
that makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
And if you doorknobs are up high, so they have to reach up to do the doorknobs. And that was, again, a conscious thing to make them look like little kids.
I gotta love the Italians.
But, you know, the thing with Suspiria is that, like we said, it starts right out of the gate because we get the scenes of her in the airport and the cab with the color. And then she gets to the school and then things kind of just, they take kind of a hard left as we follow the other girl into what is, you know, rightfully considered one of the absolute best sequences ever filmed in a horror movie ever, which is that double murder right at the beginning.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
Well, kind of a double murder because, you know, technically it's just one murder and the other girl gets, you know, hit by falling glass. But yeah, that was really a disturbing scene, especially the way that whoever was doing the stabbing into the person, that was far too realistic. I mean, especially when they get to the part where she's almost gutted and you see the knife going into what looks to be a still beating heart. So that's really a creepy and graphic scene.
Well, it's not only the knife goes into the heart, it pulls out, then you see the slit in the heart, and you just get to see a little bit of blood bubble out as the heart's still beating, you know, as it's pumping air through the hole in it. And yeah. That's pretty intense, even for today.
I think her head dangling down through the stained glass is that's to me is just like, ooh, that's even creepier than the still beating heart.
And but again, we talked about this a little bit on the Profondo Rosso episode, the whole mise-en-scene there of the lighting, the sound, the visuals, it all comes together into form just as something that really sticks with you. The part I always loved in that is, you know, she's in the bathroom and she's looking out, and she's looking out the one window, and she sees the eyes appear out the window, and she's staring intently out that window, and then the hand comes through the other one. And that one, I love that, because it's a complete misdirection of what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting there, again, she, you know, then the next time we see her, the where she is, the scene has completely changed. And that again, that's another visual tip that this is not going to be something like Deep Red, where everything, you know, is taking place in a real environment. This is just a nightmare. And, yeah, and then, you know, going through that, the glass clashing down, and my wife was starting to watch this with me, and I said, I think you might like this, because I know you like supernatural stuff. I said, but I'll tell you when to look away. And she crashes through the glass. I said, okay, now you want to look away. And she looked away for a minute. She was like, no, keep looking away. I'll tell you when you can turn back here. It's at the end of it, all right?
She's looking at her watch.
Also, just a stupid bit of trivia that I always notice. I love that the killer in that scene is not wearing gloves.
For once, yeah.
Because it's not a giallo film. It's a supernatural type of film, so the killer doesn't necessarily need to be wearing gloves. So.
Well, it's funny. What I was thinking is, like, the American supernatural film, you know, that was sort of in vogue, you know, Rosemary's Baby era, which is, I'm sort of putting this into that sort of time period.
The Omen was made around the same time as well.
And those movies like to set up everything as normal. And then slowly you start seeing weirdness around the edges and putting it together. This one is literally screaming it at you with everything it's got from the set before she even gets to the school. Just when she's, you know, her taxi ride is foreboding, and you know the taxi driver is kind of hostile, and you know, and people are driving next to her car and shining green lights in her eyes the whole way over there and stuff, and you know, and every introduction of a scene there's, you know, foreboding music, and she's doing, you know, the wide-eyed I'm just walking by something. She's walking around like she's in mortal fear, but there's nothing happening.
Yeah.
It's just this sense of it, you know? And that starts from the very beginning. And then it's just like almost the opposite. It sort of notches down a little bit, you know, for a little while. And then it would, you know, and a lot of in American and supernatural movies too, they're also like, to let it go for a while and make you think, well, you know, this might be a coven of witches, but, you know, it doesn't really have to have an actual supernatural element. They just could be a crazy coven of witches. But this one, you definitely get the sense that that there are things being made to happen by, you know, invisible hands, literally, you know, in the air around you. Mm-hmm. Rather than, you know, somebody who's just a psycho killer who's happens to be a satanic worshiper or something.
Yeah, I mean, the part that I always thought was very subtly done in this film, and this is a film where most things are, you know, so right in your face that it's hard to be subtle. But when the hex is put on to Susie when she's walking down the hall to go to her class, and then one of the older ladies is sitting there with the young nephew, and they shine the bright light on her, and and then she's hexed, and she starts wigging out.
Yeah,
you know. I mean, first off, I love, again, just he, you know, Argento's not afraid just to white out the camera with the bright light there. But then, you know, it's not anything more than just a flashing of a light. And it's, you know, that to me is, if I'm going to use the term realistic occult, and I put air quotes around that, that makes more sense to me than some, you know, grand and expensive special effect like you might see in an American film.
Mm-hmm. It was beautiful cinematography, too, because not only did you see the light and it sort of whited out the camera, the light lit all the dust in between her. So there was this nice little band of dust in the air that you didn't see before, and then the light lights it up. It was really nice.
Yeah, that's a great. I love that. And then, of course, the her flailing around in the class after that. Again, speaking to my position as a Phantom of the Paradise fan, that's exactly it. We see Jessica Harper on film dancing twice. Both times she's dancing incredibly badly.
Yeah, that's one of the things I kind of wanted to mention, is that they didn't seem to pick a person who is going to, for a film that's going to be set around a dance studio or a ballet studio, they picked probably one of the worst actors to do any type of dancing that they could.
Well, that's why her only dancing scene was when she was hexed, so she had an excuse for being so clumsy.
Yeah, in Phantom, she's just flailing around the stage. She has no excuse.
Right. But, yeah, I kept finding... I just want to say that I've been having fun with the Italian movies, but this one was like where I literally went into having a riot. I love movies like this, you know, Kurt Russell. Russell am I thinking of?
Russell Mulcahy.
Ken Russell.
Ken Russell.
Another K Russell. You know, Ken Russell, movies that are loud, bright, and just crazy and dreamlike and hallucinogenic. And this gave me everything. This is the only Dario Argento movie I saw it over a decade ago. And it was also one of my first Italian... It was my first Italian movie, horror movie. So I had a lot to get used to on that first viewing. And I remember really liking it, but like being like, wow, the music was really cheesy. And now I listen to Goblin, you know, just when I'm doing Photoshop and stuff, you know. I love the music of it. I don't think of it as being cheesy 60s music. I just think of it as something that was made to go along with the lurid images, and as such, it, although I think Sean and I were talking before this that it was, or I think we all were, wasn't it recorded before they'd made the movie, so he just used this. And it's really dissonant, Goblin, too.
It wasn't recorded specifically for the movie, but they've been, you know, it does have that sort of feel of very otherworldly and other, you know, strange and avant-garde. So, they have moved it, used it in a bunch of different movies. I think they used it in some Japanese movies and...
One of the few things is that Claudio Simonetti, who's the head of Goblin, he recorded all the whispering and the spoken word.
Mm-hmm.
A witch, you know, something like that. He did that, and that is that. I think you'll only find in this take on it. But you're right. If you listen to enough obscure film music, you'll get notes and bits of the Suspiria soundtrack and others. But I have the soundtrack to this. You can find it online, and if you have the Anchor Bay 3-disc collection of Suspiria, the third disc is the soundtrack. And it's, if you listen to this outside of the context of the film, it's just so strange and so experimental and prog in so many ways. I mean, there are just tracks of just progressive rock style drumming. And you're like, wow, how could this be a horror movie soundtrack? But then you marry it with what Argento is doing visually, and the whole thing just really gels and comes together, and it makes something that's so memorable that it's no surprise that this film is always touted. I said this last time. You know, film critics like to put this on their 10 best list of horror movies so they can seem like they've done some, you know, they've watched some things besides things that were released in America, you know. It's an easy pick because it's a good movie and it's so visually different from just about anything else that you're going to find in the same time period that it's an easy pick to say, yeah, this is a top 10 film.
Well, my note on it is very musical editing, I wrote down. And, you know, the way that the scenes are cut, there's a lot of scenes that are cut to the music. Right at the very beginning, when she's in the cab, when she's coming through the woods just before getting to the academy, you see the headlights sort of pop up over a hill and come from behind a tree. And the second you see the headlights pop up, you know, you hear a voice go, ha! On the soundtrack. And it's not really cut like a music video, but to me it was cut very musically, you know, like he was working with themes and colors and stuff. And I watched this morning and both of my roommates were still asleep, and I was really afraid that I was going to wake them up, because every time there was dialogue, I had to turn the speakers way up to hear what people were saying, and then the music would start and the whole house would rattle. You know, and I was riding the volume all the way through the movie. You know, whenever music would start, I'd have to turn it way down.
Well, I think a lot of this probably comes from the fact that the dialogue and really kind of the story of the film is kind of inconsequential to the look and the feel of it.
Oh, yeah.
The look and the feel of this movie are really what grab you and take hold of you and really engage you. The plot, you know, could be pretty generic. It's a person who discovers a coven of witches, gets hexed by them, and has, horrible things happen. We've seen that, you know, in, like, Rosemary's Baby, you mentioned that, stuff like that. So that story isn't really all that original, but the look and the feel of this movie and the soundtrack of it is what grabs you, and that's what I think you could take away from this, is making it so original and so unique.
Well, they could have done so much more with the story. You could have found out what the witches were up to. Mm-hmm. You know, I was getting the idea that maybe they lured, you know, it was a Wicker Man sort of thing, you know, where they might have lured her there because for some reason and were going to use her for a ceremony or something. But in what I'm finding is a very typical Italian style, it's just sort of things happen, and She finds out they're witches, and when she strikes down the head witch, it's just like everything bursts into flames and the credits start rolling.
Shit, yeah. It goes fast in Argento movies.
There's no epilogue or little wind down or stinger or anything. It's just like, well,
this has been Suspiria.
Yes, no more. Nothing more to show here.
Which is probably for the best, because the one time I can really think of Argento doing an epilogue, which was in opera, it didn't turn out very well.
It didn't work too well.
No, because the epilogue in opera looks like basically if you crossed The Sound of Music with Deep Red.
Oh.
Just picture a crazy killer running through the hills of Bavaria.
Oh, man, I'd love to see all those Von Trapps get slaughtered. That would be amazing.
Awesome. It's like, that gives new meaning to, you know, so long, farewell, Auf Wiedersehen, goodbye.
Yes.
But, and, you know, and what's funny is one of the taglines of this film was the only thing scarier than the last 5 minutes of this film is the first 93. And to me, that's... Again, like you were saying, Chris, things just kind of happen because they have to, because that's the sequence of events. But the last 5 minutes of this film, everything comes off the rails. Once Susie finds the secret entrance to the coven, and then, I mean, that to me is, I mean, as silly as it sounds, the tagline is true, because the end of that, those last 5 minutes of this movie are just to me, just stupendous horror filmmaking. You know, going through and finding her... you know, the corpse of her friend that's been gussied up on the table.
With the pins in the eyes.
Yeah, and the big lighter, and the coven saying, we have to kill the American. And then she goes into Helena's room. It's like, all of that's just great. Well,
let's not forget, creepy kid.
Yeah.
In the little school uniform as well. That's... like the little Lord Fauntleroy kid.
Yes, with big, stary eyes. Creepy, stary eyes.
I tell you, but then when Sarah's reanimated corpse, when Elena says their death lies beyond that door, and the corpse bursts through, I mean, that's one of my favorite shots of Argento's entire library. I just love that. It's just a classic zombie sort of, post Romero zombie beat. But it's just at that point when it happens right then, you're just in the right mindset for it when it hits, and it's just a great, great bit of filmmaking.
Well, when you really don't expect it either. You don't expect her friend to come back. I mean, this is a witch's coven. You think that maybe they'll have something supernatural happen, but you don't expect, a reanimated corpse of her friend to come back. So that was, for me, the first time watching, that was kind of unexpected.
And that's almost a throwback sort of to something we might have seen from Mario Bava. I wouldn't have been surprised to see something like that in Black Sunday, for instance.
Oh, yeah.
Minus the pins in the eye were really what did it for me. That was just like the creepiest, because usually you don't see, prosthetic where something's in the middle of your eye. You know what I mean? Like that open eye on top of it.
What's kind of funny is Suspiria is the first film in a rough trilogy. Which is generally called the Three Mothers trilogy, and it deals with the three mothers of that are great, powerful witches. And the first film is Suspiria, the second film is Inferno, and then the third film was one of Argento's latest films, which is the Third Mother. Creatively enough, in Inferno, which we're not going to cover on this, because Inferno is a lot like Suspiria, except it makes even less sense. Mm-hmm. If you can believe. It's just, it really is like a nightmare where things will just change for no explicable reason, because that's what happens in a dream. But there's a scene towards the end of Inferno that's very similar to this, and it involves, a man reaching for a mirror and the mirror smashing, and there being, in this case, a animated skeleton on the other side. But again, it's that kind of classic horror trope that Argento likes to trot out in his supernatural films, and it got, this was the first time. So I really love that whole bit. It's so different from the majority of his films, which are, giallo and have an element of realism to them. To go completely into left field with the supernatural is a nice change.
I just kept finding myself wondering, is this guy is he a conscious genius, or is he a partially unconscious genius? Is a lot of it just because he's maybe a little crazed and really quirky, and so you get that element of it. But then there would be little shots that reminded me of the shots that reminded me of Hitchcock were weird. He would do a little tracking shot down to just an item. That Hitchcock, though, would do that because that item had some meaning or referred to something. It's almost random with Argento, yeah. I noticed. He just like, ooh, that's pretty over here.
Well, the other thing that, referencing Hitchcock, one of the things that he liked to do was the unblinking eye. And we saw that, I think, a lot with the shots down the hallway of the sort of mirrored mm-hmm. glass that light was shooting through. And plus also the beginning murder scene where you've got the stained glass on the ceiling that's in the sort of shape of an eye. So that was kind of, I'll go along with that as sort of Hitchcock aesthetic going on.
There's a lot, if you watch through the film, there's a lot of geometric designs and patterns all over
the place.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because I think the first time I watched it, I never really picked up on that. But watching it now, trying to watch it much more critically, you pick up on little things like that. And a lot of that, is standing stuff that was used. But, constructing those sets in that way is just very creative, and especially for something like a school where you really kind of had carte blanche to design it however you want. A school in Europe like that, who knows what it looks like on the inside, Who knows when the building was built. And then it comes around and kind of has a bit of fridge logic, and it makes sense that it looks like that considering the school was built for the purpose of being a place to study, and I love this, dance and the occult.
right. Well, that's the one obligatory exposition part where you have two, you have the old professor character, and the guy who would normally be like the love interest,
Udo Kier.
Was that Udo Kier?
Udo Kier.
Oh yeah,
the young guy, Dr. Mandel. Udo Kier.
I did not recognize him at all.
Really?
No.
With those piercing eyes, you couldn't tell it was him.
I have a friend who went on a date with Udo Kier.
That's frightening. Yeah. Boy or girl?
Girl.
Whoa, that's a change up for him.
Not according to her.
Oh, get her on the show.
Wow.
That's dish.
But yes, but, it was a book here.
But yeah, he would have. That would have normally been perhaps a love interest, or the German Ashton Kutcher guy in there too.
But again, you know, that also kind of gets back to the idea that they're supposed to be 12. You know,
right, right.
Love interest means you might get one kiss and hold hands if you're 12. You know.
Yeah. So they did a little bit of talking about him, like, ooh, he likes you, and that was about it. Yeah.
I also love the that in an Italian film, red wine is considered medicine.
Of course.
Yes. And of course,
when she pours that red wine into the sink, it's just like, that's no wine I would ever drink.
Yeah.
I think that wine's been sitting around for a little too long.
Yeah, it's pretty thick wine.
Pretty chalky.
I just love that, you know, because, you know, we see her with it. We never really see her drinking it. We see her looking at it in the glass, and then when she pours it out, just that, again.
No, well, actually, we get that first person view of her.
That's like the camera view of it.
Where it's like the camera is sort of her at an angle, you know, and it's that was another weird, weird shot.
When she pours that whatever it is down the sink, and again, just that the bright, oversaturated red against the white, just that's again, just like first time you see it, that's like, oh, geez. And you know what's funny with color here is that this was in Technicolor. It's one of the last films to be processed in Technicolor, but it uses the what's called the imbibation Technicolor, mm-hmm. which is the same type of technique that was used in films like Gone with the Wind and The Wizard of Oz to get the vivid, really vivid colors, which much more so than the regular Technicolor process. So that's why we get that, you know, really oversaturated look. And, you know, you talk about three films, couldn't be more different, you know, Gone with the Wind, The Wizard of Oz, and Suspiria. Yes. Although all three give you nightmares if you watch them in the right mindset, I think.
Yeah.
we're looking at you, Chris.
Me?
No, the other Chris.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and once again, like, the meat getting cut in this, people's meat getting cut was very realistic, but once again, it had that Italian bright red paint blood.
Yeah. Yep. You know, again, but that's still part of the
if the blood was too realistic, it might have been just a little, it might have been too gory.
Yeah, it's design. I mean, the unreality of it just adds to the nightmarish aspect. And and talk about a nightmare aspect, when the maggots start falling from the ceiling.
Oh. No, let's not talk about that.
There's just something about creepy, crawly things falling on you that's just, I don't care, man or woman, young or old, that's just freaktacular right there. That's all that is.
I don't mind most bugs, but I see maggots, and because I think your mind just automatically goes to, there's only maggots there because something's fucking dead.
Something's dead. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Decomposing.
Oh, I hate maggots.
Yeah, I mean, that's, and then, you know, when you look, they're all crawling over the place, it's like, oh, that is...
Well, when you think about it, that's the woman whose ghost is running the place, or, you know, who's the old witch who's running the place is basically probably, you know, dead. She's rotting, you know, keeping herself alive through magic. So there was lots of nice little metaphors like that, but they never went into anything because you never really learned anything about the witches.
No.
Nothing.
It's there for you to think about, but it's not in a package, you know?
But, like, I mean, but in an instant, like, there was that one scene when she, at the end, the one you were talking about, where she's in the hallway hiding and she sees them all talking about killing her. And the little kid, you know, has the big, the guy with the dentures bend down and he whispers in his ear. And then I'm thinking, that kid's like 500 years old. that kid's like, you know, super smart or something, you know, you could just, you know, it just gave you a lot to chew on.
Well, yeah, and you can make those assumptions because they don't spell it out for you.
Right,
they don't
say
that this is their purpose, this is why they're here, this is why they're doing that. That's left up to your imagination, which is what's really nice in these Italian films, that you're not, you know, and what we see kind of in the American films tend to spell it out to you. And
yes,
this one allows you to use your mind to try and fill in all the blanks that are left there. So that's really a fun thing that the Italian films do.
Well, a lot, the thing about spelling it out is sometimes I want it spelled out, but for the most part, when they spell stuff out, it's all stuff you really don't need for the movie, but they spell it out to just explain things for people. And that always annoys the hell out of me. And so, yeah, I love it when this with this where, you know, you can just do these little touches and let people take it from there.
Right. I mean, because Susie doesn't know what's going on. You know, she never discovers what their grand plan, if any, is. So it's I kind of agree with you in this sense. It's leaving the audience to think about it on their own. It makes us put into the same shoes as our heroine. And Sean, you talked about using your imagination and filling in the blanks yourself. The scene where the piano player, Daniel, is walking the piazza with his dog, and then something is there. We know something is there because the dog starts freaking out, but we never see anything.
We see a shadow of, like, it looked like they just ran a lot of people by a light.
Yeah.
But it was this vague shape, runny sort of thing.
I don't know, and we get a kind of a swoopy camera.
Right.
We also get the guy looking around. Well, not really looking around, but turning his head left and right, and the dog doing the same.
Right, so they're hearing things.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's, you know, we don't know if it's a spirit, if it's a hex, if the dog is possessed when it then turns and tears out the throat, just right there, just jumps up and tears the throat out of the guy. And that's something that would be revisited in other films, including another film we're going to watch later on in this series. But there, it just comes so out of left field because, you know, I mean, you're watching, the first time I'm watching this, I'm thinking, okay, the guy's going to just, I don't know, burst into pustules or something, you know, they're going to hex, going to die. But to turn the dog on him makes perfect sense in retrospect, but it's so cruel when you're watching it to have the guy's own guide dog turn on him and tear him apart like that, you know?
I liked his line when he got in the fight and was fired, and he's like, I might be blind, but I've got ears.
Yeah.
And that's when you know he's done. That's great, because he's you know, he's blackmailing him a little bit, or, you know, he's threatening him a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. That's just... And then, you know, when Sarah's running away from whomever is chasing her, my main note, I've got Sarah's pursuit, reds, blues, greens, because, you know, it's just every room has a different color. And I like the one she sees her escape from one room into the next. You can see the yellow actually peering from the room into this room that she's in.
Mm-hmm.
So that room's already bright yellow before she even gets there. You know? So that, I thought that was neat. And of course, then, you know, the barbed wire room. It's one of those things, look down before you jump.
Well, yeah, and who keeps... Oh, go ahead, Chris.
I was going to say, don't jump into barbed wire.
Well, her character was, as if you're thinking of her 12-year-old, she was the most hysterical of the 12-year-old girls. She was a mess.
Yeah.
So she did all the dumb things that every dumb girl does in a movie. She falls down and, you know, instead of looking for a weapon, she just sort of, like, backs up against the wall and cowers and stuff while they work the lock for a while. You know, it takes her a while to try to escape.
That work in the lock is great, too.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, Jesus.
I started getting the feeling that they were just purposely working the lock to give her time to go through the window to fall into the razor wire, basically.
And who keeps an entire room filled with just unwound twines of barbed wire? I mean,
razor wire.
Yeah. Ballerinas.
Yeah, razor wire. Yeah. What? Who?
Ballerinas. They need it, don't they?
I guess.
I don't know.
Well, there were like tools hung on the wall, so it was sort of like, okay, this is some razor wire just stored away, you know, for the grounds and stuff. But why would you have razor wire on the grounds anyway? The only place I've ever seen razor wire was on a military base, you know, when they were doing...
Well, but you know, that's part of the nightmare aspect. And in a nightmare, you can't see something that's right in front of you.
Yeah, so, no, I think he just thought of a horrible way to go, and they worked that into the script. They're like, because when they were probably reading something about razor wire, it's like, oh, well, when you move, it just wraps tighter around you, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, I see how I would film that. And that scene was mercifully Like, that scene could have been a lot bloodier. It could have been a lot of close-ups of the razor wire digging in.
Right.
But instead, it was more just portrayed by the actress flailing around and screaming.
Yeah, you know, that's the thing about Suspiria, is that it's hard, I think, to, you know, reasonably discuss this film in an audio medium, just because it's such a visual film, you know?
Oh, yeah.
So we talk about, oh, it's red, it's blue, it's green, and somebody listening to this who hasn't seen the film, but like, okay, I have primary colors right here in my box of crayons.
Well, at least we'll have the soundtrack going in the background, so if you can sort of interpolate the music that you've been hearing into visuals, you get some sort of idea.
Yeah.
I think this would be a bad movie to drop acid and watch.
It depends on who you are, but it could be, yes.
Yeah,
my
bad.
With Suspiria, is I was doing this before my wife and I had our first child. I used to host fairly regularly horror movie marathons.
I thought you were going to say something like, "I used to do a lot of acid and this."
I used to fry my brain.
Watch Suspiria.
Well, we used to do. I used to do my horror festicons, is what I called them, and they would always be a four-film evening. We'd watch four films, and they were tied together with some theme. And the last one I did, which was right before my oldest son was born, Suspiria was the anchor. It was the fourth film, so it was about 1 o'clock in the morning. We started watching this film, you know, and we'd all had been, you know, enjoying our favorite adult beverages, and I just remember. Yes. Right at the beginning, you know, and right before the murder of Pat in the apartment through the window, you know, right at staring out the window and starting to get all freaked out and everything, my friend Mac turns to me and, as serious as a heart attack, he goes, "Dude, I am seriously fucking scared right now." I'll always remember that as long as I live. Just the absolute, just, you know, whatever he had been drinking, that cut right through. He's like, "I am seriously..." And that was when the hand smashed through the window.
Yeah, it's that taking it that extra beat longer. then you get scared.
Yep. And you know, and this is you know, and I wanted to ask you guys about this. You know, we've watched Profondo Rosso and Suspiria, which again are generally, depending on which critic you read, called Argento's best films. But to me, it seems like this would. That seems to me that Suspiria would be a difficult film to show to a person who had never seen an Argento film before as a first time. What do you guys think about
well,
that?
Well, that's what happened with me.
Tell you my story. Oh, go ahead.
I mean, I had said, I never saw a Dario Argento movie, and she picked this one out specifically. She was like, "Well, no, you probably should start with Suspiria." And it worked for me. I mean, I enjoyed the hell out of it.
When I was rewatching this, I said, "Holy shit, I saw this on AMC about 15 years ago, or 12 years ago, whatever it was. Didn't realize that I was watching something that I had already seen." I said, "Oh, okay, now I know what's going on." It was just a kind of weird sense of deja vu. So I think this actually was the first Argento movie I saw. I just didn't realize it at the time. And, I mean, visually and stylistically, it works for me. I mean, like every other Italian horror movie we've watched, the story's a little thin, but yeah, it's not really the point.
Yeah, for me, Luke started me out on the stuff, and he got me to watch Tenebre, then Deep Red, and then I moved to this. So I kind of came from it in a different angle. But I think, personally, I would have been, if I would have watched this originally, I would have been just kind of, you know, shell-shocked, because it is so stylistically and visually different than a lot of, you know, it'd be kind of hard to take in the rest of the stuff without going, is it going to be as weird as this? So I'm glad that I kind of stepped in with the less avant-garde stuff and then worked up to this. So I like the direction that we started this Italian film series with.
It just reminded me, the same woman I was talking about who had the date with Udo had the was the one who turned me on to this movie. And that's... I remember her saying, "This isn't his best movie. This is just the one you should start with." To her, and this was her, she's a freak. And I love weird, bizarre stuff, so maybe that's why she was like picked something a little more colorful and bizarre.
Yeah.
For me, for my first one.
I mean, colorful definitely describes this one.
Yeah.
I mean, it really depends on who you're trying to, you know, the tastes and preferences of the individual that you're going to, you know, introduce to the genre. You know, if you've got someone who, is just not really interested in the mise-en-scène aspect of film, who's not going to really particularly care about the color and sound combination, is just going to say, well, why is it there? Then maybe don't start with this. But I think if you want to give somebody a really good primer on, you know, what I call how the horror house meets the art house that we get with a lot of these sort of modernist films from the 70s and even moving through to today. And we're starting to see this more across, all over, that we're introducing more of these elements into the indie films. And this is probably the best place to start. So it really does depend. And, you know, but, you know, you should know the mindset of the individual you want to introduce a film to, because otherwise that could just end.
It could go horribly wrong. Yes.
Yeah. If I ever date a burgeoning ballerina, I'll definitely show her this one.
followed up with Black Swan. That'll really help out as well.
I still haven't seen that yet.
Megadeth has been called Black Swan, so that's close enough for me.
Okay.
So you guys really weren't in a hurry at all to see Mila Kunis and.
If they were both actually naked, I would have been there opening night. But since, you know,
was it Body Devils? Oh.
See, that was, you know, that was just another weird, disturbing Aronofsky film that I just it didn't make me sad. It didn't make me as hateful and sad as Requiem for a Dream. But it was just as weird and disturbing.
Yeah. Requiem for a Dream is definitely not a feel-good movie.
Depends on what you're feeling like, though, I guess.
Yeah, it depends on who you are, that's for sure, but...
Yes.
So you guys were talking about... I just thought you meant Brian De Palma when you said Body Double. That's all I thought. I'm like, I love Body Double. That's a good movie.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Not to be confused with Body of Evidence. Is that the Madonna movie?
Oh, God.
It's funny, I just brought that up. Somebody was talking about that director, and they'd put up a post about all these filmmakers talking shit about each other, and Vincent Gallo said something about Abel Ferrara, I guess, is a director that was more interested, I guess, in smoking crack on the set than directing. and I had a friend of mine who worked on, I think that he directed Body of Evidence with Madonna in it. I had a friend who worked on that. And that was basically what he said. He would sit, while he was directing, he would just sort of smoke crack all the way through. Explaining why you don't see a lot of Abel Ferrara movies these days.
Need to cut in the line from... Jesus, what's the name of that movie?
Cocaine's a hell of a drug.
No, I was thinking, you smoke crack, don't you? Which is from Lean On Me. That's somebody...
Crack kills your brain cells, son.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Expeditiously! My brain was saying, Stand By Me. I'm like, that's wrong, Luke. It's not Stand By Me.
Yeah, there wasn't much crack in Stand By Me, I don't think. It was just that one short scene, and that was it.
I'd love to see a mashup of Stand By Me and Lean On Me. That would be... That'd be...
Oh, Jesus.
Oh my gosh.
We've gone completely off the rails.
I was just going to say, how far from Italy are we right now?
Oh, I don't know. A long way away.
But you know, again.
Let's return to the land of pasta.
The land of the pasta. So, I mean, I loved rewatching Suspiria. It'd been a couple of years since I'd seen it. And it's such a unique movie because even some of our, like I said, some of the other films that Argento and his contemporaries would make. Inferno is the one that's always said is closest to Suspiria, and it's just nowhere near the same level of quality as a film. I mean, this is such a unique cinematic experience, and it's just a joy to me to watch this because it is the ultimate, I think I said, the ultimate combination of horror film and art film, you know?
And another one with a title that has absolutely nothing to do with anything. Never mentioned in the film...
It retroactively becomes meaningful because the it's Mater Suspirium is the name of the mother from the three mothers.
Oh, okay.
So there's and it's Mater
retconned.
Yeah, well, basically it happens because they talk about it in Inferno, which is Mater Lacranium, I think, is Our Lady of Tears, and they talk about Our Lady of Sighs, which is Mater Suspiriorum, and then the third mother deals with Mater Tenebrarum, I think, which is the Lady of Darkness, which is the makes the three mothers. But yeah, in the film, the title is just inspired from the, I don't know if it's a poem or something, which had that title, that came kind of an uncredited inspiration as Argento and Nicolodi were writing the script. And this, and also from Nicolodi's experience that supposedly her grandmother had told her about a school very similar to this that was teaching, you know, art and the occult. Because those two options go together. I just picture the art students from, like, my high school, a bunch of, you know, skinny, you know, 98-pound 16-year-olds. I'm going to cast a hex on you, man. Don't mess with me.
Hey, it's like a weird perverted version of Hogwarts.
A lot of the art students in my high school were metalheads, and they were doing like Iron Maiden album covers and stuff. So you didn't mess with any of the art students.
Let's see, that's when you went to school versus when I went to school.
What I wouldn't have given to have been born about 8 years earlier than I was. Would have been in my heyday. Would have been amazing.
I don't know.
That's neither here nor there. That's from my own podcast. Rueful, mournful recollections with the Hair Metal Hero.
People be lining up for that title.
Nobody. Yeah, like, you morose, self-righteous prick. We're not listening to your crap.
Sounds like something to put a little,
That's something we can get a feed for on the new Two True Freaks website, eh?
Funny you mentioned that, Sean. What?
Yeah, did anyone know that there's going to be a new Two True Freaks proper website? Well, has anyone heard about that?
I'll tell you what, by the time they hear this, they better be hearing it on that.
Oh, yeah.
So welcome to twotruefreaks.com.
Yeah. Yeah, it's almost like we're a legitimate organization now.
Yep.
Yeah.
The monster money helps us.
Now we have to just start getting money coming in, and then it will be even more like a legitimate organization.
Yeah, actually, no.
Actually, working for Demonza Corp, we are a legitimate corporation, but there's actually quotes on that.
Yeah,
legitimate.
Well, what's funny is that, you know, somebody asked me, they said, "You make any money doing this?" And I said, "No." They said, "Oh, are you a nonprofit?" I said, "Well, there's a difference between a nonprofit and a no profit."
A nonprofit actually brings money in, and to pay for its expenses,
Yeah, we're in the red.
we're in the profondo red. That's how red we are right here. We're in the superior red here.
Well, as hobbies go, it's cheaper than golfing, that's for sure.
It's a hell of a lot cheaper than my $10,000 a day Fabergé egg addiction. I can tell you that right now.
Yeah, it's cheaper than drugs. Except crack. Anybody can get that.
You see, now I'm seeing the commercial with Luke cracking a Fabergé egg and being like, "This is your brain on drugs."
$10,000 down the tube.
There goes $10,000. Yeah.
Oh, Jesus. So, anybody have any final thoughts on Suspiria? Anything you want to add?
I had a riot.
Was it just me, or did our lead heroine look a lot like a very young Karen Allen?
Yeah.
She does. Eyes
and the hair. And the
I don't usually go for the wavy look, but that she was cute.
Yeah, I think Jessica Harper, especially from this era, may actually be the actress I consider to be the cutest. I mean, I love her in Phantom because she's just so adorable. And then here, she gets, you know, even more time to look cute. So,
and she's in a one-piece, swimming.
Yeah, it's like the most demure scene ever of two ballerinas swimming.
Yeah, but you can actually see their nipples emerge when they step in the water. I love it.
Yep.
Usually, I
was like, "Ooh, that water's cold." I'm like, "Ooh, this is take one."
Take one. That's all only take you need when that happens.
Yeah, this was...
pays for itself.
Maybe it was because it was originally written for 12 years old girls, but this movie was a little less pervy than it really could have been.
Yeah.
Judging by having a room, a school full of ballerinas in tight garb.
Yes, yes.
I'd actually like to see that remade with the 12-year-olds. Let Argento have another crack at it with the 12-year-olds. That would be something else.
I think it would be. I think it would be even scarier if it was done right. You know, it could, and I think you could get away with it these days, I think.
Yeah. The menacing children in a movie always works.
And it would be really good for, you know, I mean, really 12, 13 years old is where you start, like, getting to see some of the R-rated horror movies, you know, outside, you know, when you sneak away from your parents and stuff. So seeing this movie, if you were like a 12-year-old girl, would probably like give you nightmares for years.
It would scare just every little girl off of being a ballerina. And the world is a better place.
I was just going to say, that's not a bad thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fine line between the ballerina stage and then the pole, so.
That's if they remade it today. Wow. It would be definitely, they'd be pole dancers.
Like, I don't have kids. I don't have daughters, but I know that your main function as a father is that you need to keep them off the pole. That's your main job. So.
Well,
take that however you want it.
Yep.
Well, next time up, we're going to be moving swiftly along from that.
Moving away from the pole.
Yeah, on our next film in the Italian series, we're going to be finishing up our coverage of Dario Argento. We're going to be moving back away from the supernatural and into not only the 1980s, but also back to a giallo, as we're going to be covering Tenebrae. A lot of times given as his last truly great film before the descent into more mediocre types of efforts, Tenebrae's became one of the more easier available Argento films after Anchor Bay released it on DVD, and then it always seems to be around. So I'm really looking forward to watching this one again.
I've never seen it, so I'm really psyched.
Like I said, it was one of the first ones Luke got me interested in, and I loved it. So looking forward to looking at it again.
Yeah, Tenebrae, you can find it on Netflix, or I'm sure you can find it out there if you want to watch it. I think everyone, if you've been following along at all with this series, and I really truly hope you have, because, you know, part of the reason that we do this show is not only just for us to get together and talk about horror movies, but we like to shed light on, you know, some things that maybe if you're a regular, and I put regular again in air quotes, Two True Freaks listener, that you might not be interested in. If you're, you know, normally interested in science fiction or fantasy, you might not always tend towards the horror, and we hope by discussing these films that we get you interested in checking them out. So hopefully you've been checking them out, and you'll check out Tenebrae and come back and talk about that with us next time.
And little girls, stay away from the pole.
Damn right. Unless it's my pole.
Oh!
You can cut that out.
You can sponsor an episode of this or any other of your favorite Two True Freaks affiliated shows. Simply click the PayPal link on our website, donate any amount at all, tell us which show you're choosing and what message, if any, you'd like us to read on your behalf, and you will be an official sponsor of that show's very next episode, with your message read in the show's opener. It's that easy, and there is no minimum donation. Be a show sponsor today.
If you shop at Amazon.com, please consider using the link at TwoTrueFreaks.com to shop there. If you use this link to go to Amazon and then you shop, Two True Freaks gets a little cut of what you buy, and it doesn't cost you anything extra. So you get to shop as usual and help out the Two True Freaks at the same time.
Welcome to Amazon. I love you.
Visit our brand new website at twotruefreaks.com.
Two True Freaks is always spelled TWOTRUEFREAKS. Join our forum at forumforgeeks.com, where you can discuss all of the shows on our feed with us and your fellow listeners.
You can find Two True Freaks on Facebook. Just search for Two True Freaks.
And hey, you can friend me, Scott Gardner, on Facebook too. My name is spelled SCOTTGARDNER.
You can friend me on Facebook too, if you can find me.
Now available, Two True Freaks t-shirts. See our website for details.
Two True Freaks is a very proud member of the Comics Podcast Network. You can check that out at www.comicspodcast.com, where you can hear our new episodes when we put them up.
We are also members of the League of Comic Book Podcasts. For more information, visit comicbooknoise.com/league.
If you ever leave your house and you actually have friends, why don't you tell them about Two True Freaks? Thanks for listening,
and join us every Monday for new episodes of
Two True Freaks.
Shorty, oh Shorty, Shorty, if you will, please send a little dog for me to thrill. A dog who wants my kisses and my arms, a dog with all the charms of you. Shorty, make her fair. A lovely dog, yeah, with sunlight in her hair. And take the brightest stars up in the sky, ha, and place them in your eyes for me. Shorty, goddess of love that you are. Surely the things that... Shorty, what are you doing? Stop it!
We were finally invited aboard one of these spacecraft, which landed near Ann Arbor, Michigan on October the 24th of 1954. This is a drawing of the craft. As I was leaving the craft, the commander, Soltek, said, "Soon others of your people will be able to have an experience similar to this."